Hello, you are tuned in to another edition of Mountain Song and Story right here on Radio Bristol. I'm your host, Tony Doman, and here on this program, each and every week, I find and feature themes relating to Appalachian culture and folk life, and then I play songs and feature stories all about our topic of choice. Well, today I've got another great show lined up for you. I'll be speaking with not one, but two guests, Emily Hilliard and Katie Clune, to learn a little bit more about a popular topic on this show featured quite frequently, folklore. Emily is currently the program director for folk and traditional arts at Mid-Atlantic Arts, managing the Central Appalachian Living Traditions program, and she's also the former West Virginia state folklorist. Katie Clune is Virginia's state folklorist currently and director of the Virginia Folklife Program, which serves to sustain and empower the vital and diverse cultures and traditions of communities across the Commonwealth. So, if you're curious about what the role of a folklorist actually is, this is the episode for you. Today, I'll chat with Emily and Katie about their current and former roles working in folklife, and so much more. The two of them have just done so many wonderful things individually relating to supporting cultural arts. So it was so much fun to speak with them earlier this month for today's program. So please stick around and stay tuned this hour here on Mountain Song and Story. It's going to be another great show.
As I looked at the valleys down below, they were green just as far as I could see. As my memory turned, oh, how my heart did yearn for you and the days it used to be. High on the mountain, a wind blowing free, thinking about the days it used to be. High on the mountain, oh, standing all alone, wondering where the years of my life had flown. My life had flown.
All right, folks, so joining me now are my guests for today's program. Here with me today, I have Emily Hilliard and Katie Clune. Emily is currently the program director for Folk and Traditional Arts at Mid-Atlantic Arts, managing the Central Appalachian Living Traditions Program. And Katie is Virginia State Folklorist and director of the Virginia Folklife Program. First off, welcome and thank you both so much for speaking with me today for Mountain Song and Story. Welcome to Radio Bristol.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Tony.
Yeah, so right now, both Katie and Emily are here at the Birthplace of Country Music Museum in Bristol. Bristol is acting as the anchor community as part of a larger project from Mid-Atlantic Arts, the Central Appalachian Living Traditions. So we just had a giant meeting this morning and all about that, which we're really excited about. And I will have links to some of these things that I'm talking about on the blog page. So if you're listening right now, you can learn a little bit more about that program. But I thought we would start our conversation by talking a little bit about what a state folklorist does. So Katie is currently Virginia State Folklorist, a new role that she's taken on, and Emily was the West Virginia State Folklorist before transitioning into her current role. So let's start our conversation by telling listeners, our listeners, what the job or role of a folklorist is. What does a folklorist do all day?
I'm going to toss it to Emily because she was one state folklorist for 6 years, whereas I've done it for 5 months now. So,
yeah.
Okay, how do I answer this? Almost every state has a state folklorist. Often they are at state arts councils, but sometimes, like in Virginia and West Virginia, they're at state humanities councils. They could also be at a college or a university. But we work to support and document and help sustain traditional artists and cultural communities in our respective states. So in a way, I think of it as a kind of public scholar, public humanities job, but it's also you are an advocate and ally for vernacular artists of all, you know, many different disciplines, cultural communities, backgrounds, levels of proficiency. So I think one of the kind of bread and butter programs for a state folklorist is an apprenticeship program. So that's really focused on intergenerational transmission, where a mentor artist works with the often younger, but not always younger, apprentice who's more in a position of learning the cultural form, and they are funded with a stipend and often do a public program about their work. So in West Virginia, we funded apprenticeships in midwifery, sheep to shawl, raising sheep to making yarn and wool from those sheep to weaving it into a shawl. Always old time, banjo and fiddle, black gospel and blues, seed saving, you know, lots of different kind of traditions in the state of West Virginia. We also document and do field work and put those materials into an archive so they can be accessible to those practitioners, to their communities, to family members, you know, in the future, and to the general public. And then we might do things like festivals, publication, public media. I think that's a pretty good overview. Katie, do you have any gaps to fill there?
Yeah, I would say, just to summarize, we also help increase the amount of state and federal funding for folk and traditional arts, and then make decisions about how that funding is distributed in our states based on continual conversations in the field with artists and community centers and cultural leaders.
Okay. And you mentioned that every state does have a...
Almost not every state. They will soon. So now the NEA is allotting money for every state arts council to have some kind of traditional arts program.
And they were first piloted, I learned, in the mid-70s by the National Endowment for the Art at arts councils. The Virginia Folklife Program was established in 1989, so about a decade later, and then the West Virginia Folklife Program was more recently established. Emily was actually the founding director of it.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that. Yeah, so relatively not that long for some of these programs.
Definitely.
Most of them. I mean, the 70s was
not
that long ago.
And one of the reasons the NEA is, expanding its commitment to folklife programs around the state and U.S. territories is that through reviewing all of the funding support they give to the arts, they found that the folk and traditional arts programs were most likely to serve rural areas or underserved populations. And so as sort of their mandate to bring the arts to all Americans, one of the best ways the NEA can do that is through folk and traditional arts.
Yeah. So why is it so important to have this role in these different states? I mean, obviously, every state in the United States represents different groups of people. So why is it so important to have that designated person that's doing this work and really educating people about different types of art forms and just arts and culture in their localities?
You want to take that?
Sure. I mean, from the most simplistic way to explain it, if there's sort of big buckets of money from the federal government, sort of the initial intention was to have a state folklorist really embedded in the region in order to advise and make decisions about how that funding gets distributed. And I think sort of even the position of me as Virginia state folklorist in this broader Central Appalachian Living Traditions project we're part of, it's an asset to be sort of an advocate for all of Virginia, all of its regional cultural differences, and kind of figure out how you can fill in gaps and, sort of ensure that the tide lifts all boats, as the saying goes. And then on the research documentation side, as these folklife programs, both their own staff and individuals they support in the field, there's an ongoing commitment to always grow our understanding and cultural repositories of the history of the United States.
Yeah, and I think coming into West Virginia, a place that did not have a state folklife program before, although there were folklife initiatives and folklorists working in the state, there was just, obviously West Virginia is a place with vibrant, traditional culture of many different forms, but there was not a great infrastructure to support those artists and those cultural communities, not a great public-facing archive. So I found, early on going, looking for traditional culture in West Virginia online, there was so little. And that was not reflective of what actually was there, but it was just not well represented to the public. And so I think making sure that there is an advocate for these artists and cultural communities so they can sustain their traditions, so they can document their own culture. And I was kind of able to see what it looks like when a state doesn't have that infrastructure. It's just, it's nice to have, or I think it's important to have someone with their boots on the ground who has antenna for those communities and is advocating for them.
Absolutely, yes. And Katie, you just mentioned a little bit about different voices in Virginia state folk life. And one of the things that you were a part of recently here at the Birthplace of Country Music Museum was we did a film screening of the Virginia Humanities Master's and Apprenticeship program from Pat Jarrett. And I think that what was really enlightening for a viewer, if you were able to see that film, was that folk life is not just old time, or it's not just one thing. The film opened up with, I believe it was the Ethiopian coffee make traditions.
Yeah,
which
Lamlam Gebre, she received an apprenticeship to train her daughters in the traditional Ethiopian coffee ceremony. She's based out of Richmond. And so the film Tony is describing is a feature-length documentary that is essentially eight portraits of the 16 artists, so eight pairs of two artists, roughly. I guess we have a couple more because Lamlam taught both of her daughters. Of their, that showcased the traditions that they passed down and really kind of brought the viewer into the spaces in which traditional knowledge is shared. So in a luthier's shop, Lamlam's kitchen and living room, and kind of gave that behind the scenes intimate look into cultural practice.
Yeah, and I bring that up because I'm curious your take on what you want people to know when they think of folk life. Because again, I think the initial reaction to folk life, at least here in Appalachia, is can maybe be kind of geared towards like bluegrass, old time, or whatever those traditional Appalachian crafts or music is. But really, it's this diverse thing that people might not have expected it to be, the things that you just described in the folk life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, folklorists love to debate about sort of the inherent problems with the term folk life or even folklorist, because we also recognize that for, you know, someone, if you pick someone off the street and ask them what they think folklore or folk life is, you could get answers, you know, of ranging from just banjo and old time or fairy tales to something that might not be true, like, oh, well, that's not real, that's just folklore. But the way I like to think of it is it's almost, you know, a synonym might be like vibrant cultural wellness or traditional cultural practice. Really, one of the definitions we often use is the artistic expression of everyday life. So sort of the details of meaning you bring into your everyday life and that you learned through practice from a family member or from your community that gives meaning to living, that helps express who you are as a person, and also engenders a sense of community pride. For that reason, I tend to prefer the term folk life versus folklore, because it sort of gets more at this is, you know, these art forms and practices are just knit into our everyday living.
Yeah, I think that sums it up pretty well. And I'll just add that every culture has folk life, and folk life is deeply embedded in social life. So, you know, if you go to a square dance, there's a lot of different cultural practice happening. There's the caller, there's the band, there's the dancers. And if you're not dancing, you're still participating in some way. You're part of the community. You're tapping your foot. Maybe you brought a casserole or a pie for people to share. It's really a creative expression that is holistic and might have multiple different, you know, creative practices involved. But it is completely embedded in the social life of a community.
Yeah. Thank you both for putting all this together so eloquently. Like, it's very beautiful.
It's taken many years to hone this message. It's still not quite there yet, maybe, but getting there.
Yeah.
I was born in East Virginia, North Carolina, and I did go. There I called it a fair maiden, but her age I did not know. Or have
North Carolina ain't my home. I'll go back to East Virginia. People know.
All right, the Stanley Brothers there with East Virginia Blues. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Mountain Song and Story right here on Radio Bristol. I'm your host, Tony Doman, and today I am speaking with not one but two guests for the program. If you're joining in our conversation midway, I am speaking with Emily Hilliard and Katie Clune. Emily is the former West Virginia State folklorist, and she currently works at the Mid-Atlantic Arts Foundation, and Katie Clune is currently the Virginia State folklorist and director of the Virginia Folklife Program. Two wonderful guests, a great conversation so far, and we're going to go ahead and dive back on into our conversation, which was recorded here in Bristol earlier this month in August.
So I'm wondering a little bit if you could share a little bit about how each of you got involved in this career path, because it's a very specific thing, and I'm curious about your journey. How did you arrive?
I'm glad you asked us this question, because our journeys are different, but also overlapping in a key way. So I was raised in and out of the Washington, D.C. area because my dad as a Foreign Service officer for the State Department. So when I was growing up, I lived in Nassau, Bahamas, Jakarta, Indonesia, Paris, France, spent a little bit of time in Australia with my parents during college, and then my dad retired as U.S. ambassador to Laos. He served in that position 2013 to 2016. And so I was essentially raised being immersed in a different culture, as part of, you know, just sort of my own everyday living. And I think that I continue to see the influence being raised in that way has had on me in my sort of natural comfort level, being thrown into an environment where I'm, you know, maybe the only white person or definitely the only person who's not from this particular region, and just sort of approaching it with an open curiosity and a real excitement over the millions of different ways there is on this earth to live a good life. And, you know, some of that, some of how I grew up involved going to cultural sites on the weekends. So when I was a college student, I first thought I wanted to practice art. My parents weren't so excited about that, and I, you know, literally looking down the college course selection list, I saw history of art and thought, well, you know, that could be interesting, and fell into my major pretty quickly and loved it because I felt like with art history, you are trained to analyze, you know, visual evidence by accounting for the context within which it was made. So I thought I was going to have a career in museums, but through an internship with the Smithsonian Folklife Festival, and I know Emily has also worked for the Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage, I realized, okay, yes, I love art, but I love that people who make art and, you know, address why, you know, they were motivated to do it and share it even more. And so after a few years of working at the Textile Museum in Washington, D.C., I just really sort of personally wanted to go to graduate school for folklore and knew this was not necessarily a decision that would yield great economic benefit or maybe even, you know, a guarantee of employment in the field. But I sort of just did it because I really wanted to do it. And called Emily, who had recently or was, a you know, almost done with her master's in folklore from UNC Chapel Hill, and had a conversation about it. And I remember her telling me very frankly, well, you know, the job you have now is pretty good for coming out of the program.
I told her not to do it.
Yeah, she kind of told me not to, but I wanted to get out of Washington, and I did college in 3 years, so it felt like this was my time to just dig deep and maybe sort of have the credentials to do my own research as opposed to just supporting, you know, the curatorial department or culture researchers. That's how I fell into it, and I feel, you know, most of my career has been on the communications and marketing side of cultural organizations, so to have earned the position of Virginia State Folklorist is just such a something I feel so proud and humbled to have, and I'm really excited to serve the program and maybe leave it in a little bit better shape than I found it and pass it on to the next person and keep that sort of the you know, the best part of that program just growing and expanding its impact.
That's wonderful. And if you said any of that like you did in your interview, I can see why you have a job, because I'm like, you're hired.
You're hired. Thanks, Tony.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Elkhart County in northern Indiana, and my dad played old-time music and had a folk radio show, and my parents were part of a community of artisans, and we had the dance in our backyard and made the food for it and, you know, had the band. So I guess I grew up with this understanding of art as being part of community and social life. And in college, I was an English and French major. I didn't really know you could study folklore. And I had always been into folk music, but sort of suppressed that when I was in high school because it wasn't cool. and then towards the end of college, I was like, oh, yeah, this is actually cool. And, you know, got back into Harry Smith's anthology of American folk music and really kind of started playing traditional music more. I moved to Vermont. I was working in sustainable agriculture there. And just realized that every book I checked out from the library was about folk culture and specifically folk music. Shirley Collins' America Over the Water was really important to me about her work traveling with Alan Lomax in the South. She is a British ballad singer, still making great music, and saw there being a feminist angle to folklore. A lot of the ballad singers that Alan wanted to record would not sing for him, but they would sing for Shirley. And that was really compelling to me. And also the way that folklore combined all these different disciplines. So I was into food and I could bring in food, and I was into music and I could bring in music and material culture. All of these different forms could be in conversation through folklore. So I applied for some internships at the American Folklife Center and Smithsonian Folkways and lived in D.C. to do those. At the American Folklife Center, I was also transcribing tapes that Mary Hufford had done with the Coal River Project in West Virginia. And so she was really looking at the impact mountaintop removal had on traditional culture was in one specific community along the Coal River. And that was everything from mushroom hunting, Molly Moocher, you know, hunting morels. It was graveyards. It was foraging. It was hunting. all of the ways that destruction or environmental crisis worked on a landscape to actually disrupt cultural traditions. So that really showed me that folklore could be a way to do social justice work and community, you know, work in collaboration with communities for resistance against these, you know, forces of environmental and cultural hazard and crisis. So that kind of informed my path. I applied to a few different folklife programs and ethnomusicology programs, and ultimately realized that folklore was the best for me because of that multidisciplinary and focus of collaborative work with communities. So like Katie, I went to UNC and then kind of worked slowly in the field from there. I think when I told Katie not to do the, because she already had a great museum job. I don't think I had a great job at that time. So yeah, that is one part of the job. It doesn't guarantee your employment. And just as, you know, the humanities and the arts are being defunded across the country, that certainly trickles down to folklore work. So it is, it can be difficult, and folklorists kind of need to be nimble. And I, you know, I freelanced as a writer for a while and worked in media. And so I think, but that's good, because you have to have a lot of different skills to be a good folklorist. I just wish there were a few more opportunities, but yeah, we are working to do what we can to create those opportunities for young people coming into the field.
Absolutely, yes. And speaking of challenges, I know that obviously one challenge is one that you just mentioned, finding employment in your field whenever it's kind of a niche thing is very difficult. But what are, without venting, I suppose, and just to bring it up for our listeners, what are some other challenges about the work that you both do? And what's your favorite thing about it? Because it's very, you are obviously both very passionate about the fields that you're in, and they share, I mean, you've basically have had the same jobs just in different states. So, yeah, but I know funding obviously is one thing, but what are your thoughts?
Right now I'm feeling the challenge of the vast size of the state of Virginia and how there's only one of me plus support from Pat Jarrett, who's our digital media specialist. So, and that can play out, you know, in a way. During the summer I've had to make choices, like, do I go to this festival or try to, you know, be on the other side of the state for this festival? Or sometimes I'll get a call about, you know, there's this man, he's 85 years old, he plays the guitar, and you know, the guitar in a very special way, and we're not sure how much longer he'll be around. Can you come visit and interview him? And I'd love to, but, like, I, you know, my own personal life has a conflict or something. So I feel like just the challenge of, as I'm sure so many of you all feel, of not enough time, which is, you know, a different kind of resource than financial funding, but certainly an important one. I think another challenge is just communicating to people what we mean by folk life, folk and traditional arts. We hit on that with sort of the definition and what preconceived notions people might bring to that. I think another challenge is just how do you match sort of institutional support with finding practitioners all around the state? Like, just that sort of disconnect between, you know, the institutional infrastructure that are in places to support this versus matching it with people who are just living their lives and might not necessarily self-identify as an artist that could benefit from that institutional support, but, you know, if our paths were to cross, they could be, you know, one of a stellar master artist in our apprenticeship program. But there's three. I'll let Emily add to the list.
I mean, mine are definitely similar. Being a state folklorist, in a way, is an impossible job. You could feel like you're letting somebody down all the time. And so I would love to see multiple folklorists in one state working regionally. And some states do have that, like New York folklore, Maryland traditions have a folk life network where they're kind of outposts around the state. But yeah, I think kind of people and finances and time are all challenges. I think a lot of times I just want to give artists money. I just want to be able to give everyone a universal basic income. And, you know, these challenges of cultural communities and traditional arts cannot be separated from the well-being of the community they come from. So that was something in West Virginia. Communities that were affected by flooding in the 2016 floods, or that have, mountaintop removal, or there are so few jobs there, or dealing with an opioid crisis. Those impact traditional art forms because people don't have time, money, to be able to devote to those practices. So that is always something that I just like come up against. People need health insurance. They need health care. They need a way to pay rent. They need housing. And that always acts upon these traditional art forms because, like I said, it is embedded in social life. You cannot, pull these apart from each other. So that is just an overarching kind of existential challenge for me. But I think one of the things that I love about the job is, honestly, field work is something that gets me up in the morning to just be able to go and sit and talk to someone and record their story and listen. And maybe there's resources I could help them tap into, or just know that the story will be recorded for their family members in the future, or for someone to learn about what it was like to be them at this specific moment in time. That kind of storytelling aspect and documentation is so important. And when the big problems of the world get me down, it's like, well, at least I can form this, meaningful relationship with some, creative person who's doing incredible work in the world in their own community.
Yeah, that's, again, wonderful. You're hired. You're hired again. Just wondering, going off of what you just said, Emily, what do you both see about where the future of folklorists, the role of being a folklorist is, I guess, long term, because it's ever changing and folk is continuously changing all around us right now. So I'm just curious about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think about this a lot, especially now, having seen what happened to Appleshop and Heinemann's archives. I mean, yeah, we do kind of have to believe in a future to be a folklorist. We put things in an archive and, you know, hope they will be useful in the future. But what if, I mean, we are, the future is endangered. So what does that look like? Does that bring more attention to that moment of just sitting and listening to somebody? And does it put more importance on that relationship in the present? But at the same time, I do think folklorists have a lot to add to, and folklorists and the communities they work with, to the conversation and climate solutions. And a lot of the communities I've worked with and that folklorists work with have already been developing strategies for dealing with environmental crises or other sorts of crises. So what can we learn from those communities that have developed strategies for coping and for survival and thriving and maintaining their traditions? I think that there's a role for folklorists to play there. And to think about, you know, when communities are displaced, how might we help document the stories that were of a place, maybe moving to a new place or being like a diaspora of a cultural community? How can we play a role in cultural preservation in that way too? Or how can we help communities that are receiving, you know, climate refugees understand the culture of the new people who are arriving? And how can we put those cultural practices in conversation? So there's, yeah, I guess there's a lot more I could say about that, but I do think that that we need to be kind of responsive to the particular moment we're in the society in terms of climate and just like economics and all of that.
You know how sometimes you hear how nonprofits, if they, you know, fully succeeded their mission, they would cease to exist. Sometimes I think the field of folklore is somewhere along that path, just in, let's sort of paint a trajectory. The field was sort of formally established in the late 1800s as these academic societies in the U.S. were coalescing. And really, this is a very simplified version, and Emily, step in and correct me. But my understanding is essentially folklorists were scholars who really wanted to honor vernacular expression, the cultural creations of people that don't necessarily fit into the canons of art history or English literature or music. And as a result, this field kind of came as a almost a stepchild of anthropology and English and, you know, music studies. We have parts of all those disciplines, but our focus is really on people who aren't professionally trained in their fields, but rather, you know, make art based on their experience of living. And so I feel like, especially in the last couple of years, when we've seen these great sort of high culture, fine art institutions like museums reckon with the fact that they're perpetuating really what it comes down to is a class hierarchy by prioritizing these sort of fine art forms over everyday cultural expression. I think there's that is changing a little bit. There's a little bit more of a willingness to bring folk and traditional arts into the fold or to honor people sharing their own stories as opposed to having someone from outside of their community with special training like a folklorist being that sort of expert middle person. And then if you think about it on the documentation side, Alan Lomax had to carry, you know, a huge recording machine around to bring sound from one region to another, and now we've got phone in our pockets and YouTube and Spotify, et cetera, that really enable, you know, every single person that has internet access to share what they're making on their own terms. So I think that's sort of
You know, I don't have an answer for where what that means in the long term, and I think there's still a need for sort of the analysis and connection making and sort of curating that folklorists or, you know, cultural workers can provide. But that is certainly something to acknowledge here, that the field we work in, just by the nature of media development, and even some of these institutions that were gatekeepers being more willing to open up, that's certainly a positive development, and takes, I think it sometimes takes some of the pressure off, because, you know, it's not all up to us, I guess. It could never be, but... Yeah.
Well, we are running about out of time today. I want to thank you both so much for hanging out with me for today's program. We're broadcasting here out of the Birthplace of the Country Music Museum in the Radio Bristol studio while many visitors walk past the window here in the museum. Before we go, are there any upcoming projects that you all are individually working on? And please tell our listeners where they can find some things you're working on or some of your organizations where they can go to learn more about what you're doing. I will also have a link to everything you tell me in a second on the Mountain Song and Story program blog page after the show. So if you're listening and you like what Emily and Katie are talking about and you want to learn more, please go there to find some more information. And I know, Emily, you also are working on a book.
Yeah.
And Making Our Future: Visionary Folklore and Everyday Culture in Appalachia. So
yes, that might be a good place to jump off. I will plug it. So I have a book coming out with UNC Press November 22nd, and it's based on my folklife fieldwork in West Virginia, and really focused on contemporary folklife. You know, Appalachian culture and folklore often both are perceived by the mainstream as being the old-timey ways and kind of stuck in the past. So this sort of flips that and says, you know, folklore is contemporary, it's vibrant, it's evolving, and it's ways that communities are developing strategies for the future. So there's chapters on the West Virginia teacher strike, on West Virginia hot dogs, independent pro wrestling, writer Breece Pancake's hometown, some non-professional women songwriters, Fallout 76, the video game.
I love all the monsters.
So, yes, there's a Mothman in there. Yeah. So, yeah, that's coming out November 22nd, and you can find it on UNC Press's site and anywhere books are sold. You know, online, you can pre-order it, so...
That's wonderful. I'm really looking forward to that.
Thanks
so much.
I've just read the foreword and loved it. In terms of things to plug, I'd say definitely if you're in the Richmond area in early October, Virginia Folklife will be at the Richmond Folk Festival October 8th and 9th. And we are partnering with Center for Cultural Vibrancy, led by the second state folklorist of Virginia, my predecessor John Lohman, to present some traditional music on stage. I think Tony will even be on stage
with
her partner Katie Van Dyke, who will be featured in our craft area. We'll have a big workshop under one tent with about 11 different luthiers and instrument repair folks from mostly Southwest Virginia, but a couple from Lynchburg, Alexandria, and Orange, just north of Charlottesville. So check us out. And we're Virginia Folklife is actually part of the Richmond Folk Festival every year. So busy with that.
Wonderful. Well, Katie, Emily, thank you both so much for being with me today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that's the program for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. Remember, you can catch this show, Mountain Song and Story, every Thursday at 4 o'clock right here each and every week on Radio Bristol. You can also check out past episodes if you visit the Mountain Song and Story program blog page, which is found on over at listenradiobristol.org. As always, I'll have all of the materials from today's show up there. So if you want to learn more about what Katie and Emily are up to, you can find links to that on the blog page. Special thanks again to both of my guests, Emily Hilliard and Katie Kloon, for taking the time to speak with me today here on today's program. It was a wonderful conversation, and I didn't even get a chance to air the whole conversation because we had so much to say. Folks, once again, my name is Toni Doman. I thank you so much for tuning in. I am going to leave you with one more song. So we heard Black Mountain Rag there a few minutes ago by Doc Watson. Katie is from North Carolina, so we got a North Carolina tune in there. And Emily is from West Virginia, so we're going to end on a West Virginia song to take the show out. I will catch you right here next week.
Dead of the night, in the still, in the quiet, I slip away like a bird in flight back to those hills, the place that I call home. It's been years now since I left there, and this city life's about got the best of me. I can't remember why I left so free, what I wanted to do, what I wanted to see. But I can sure remember where I come from. West Virginia, oh my home. West Virginia's where I belong. In the dead of the night, in the still, in the quiet, I slip away like a bird in flight back to those hills, the place that I call home. Bird in flight back to those hills, the place that I call away like a bird in flight back to those hills, the place that I call home, home.